Hi, Chief Halton here at Fire Engineering Podcasts, and we are being brought to you by Tenkata Protective Fabrics and their Made for Life podcast hosted by Stuart Perry. The Made for Life podcast unearths the work experiences of real men and women who rely on the protective clothing and equipment to get the job done. From firefighters to industrial workers to military personnel, recent episodes explore the dangers and challenges of wildland firefighting, peer counseling for first responders, and the ins and outs of turnout gear. It's the Made for Life podcast from Tenkata Fabrics. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And thank you for listening to Fire Engineering.
Welcome to the Command Show.
Titan 5, Engine 101.
With Anthony Castros and Ed Hadfield. Let's start the show.
Hey everybody, it's Anthony Castros coming to you live from a lot of places tonight. I'm in California. We got friends from Columbus, Indiana, and Waco, Texas, and Montana, and parts unknown. So thanks for joining us. It's going to be a great show tonight. Oh, also a shout out to our brothers and sisters in Oklahoma, too. We're going to have a heck of a show tonight. I'm really excited about it. Before I get into the details of what we're going to talk about tonight, I do want to acknowledge what we always do, which is the NIOSH 5. And the NIOSH 5, or the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health causal factors of not only line of duty death, but just bad stuff on the fire ground. If you have a near miss, if you have a significant injury, if you have missed victims or excessive fire losses or just sloppy fire ground operations, chances are the NIOSH 5 are at work and present. And they are lack of or improper risk management. That's us not seeing what we have, not doing a lap when we can, and not assessing and understanding the risk at hand. Number two is really bad communications. We all know that's the problem, the fire service on the fire ground. It's a no-brainer. Another major factor is lack of or improper accountability, lack of or improper incident command, getting behind the curve, having way too big for the incident commander to manage, not having a good understanding of and a good incident command system set up. And finally, lack of SOGs, not having them in your department or not following them or having them in your region. So what I'd like to do is introduce some very special people tonight. We were very fortunate. 2 weeks ago, our team from TrainedFirefighters.com went out to Columbus, Indiana Fire Department. This was a planned event. We went out there. I think we've been working on it probably for the better part of a year and a half or two to come out to Columbus and do a command train-the-trainer workshop for our brothers and sisters at Columbus, Indiana Fire Department. And they worked their butts off to get an AFG grant to pay for the whole thing. And we went out and spent 5 days with some wonderful hospitality and some amazing firefighters from the fire chief on down. And everybody was wonderful, all in and hospitable. The first 2 days was the operations level class. We had folks from Florida, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Iowa, Nevada, and all over Indiana. And then we continued 3 more days of train the trainer, which included 2 days of hands-on training. The students were in turnouts, SCBAs. We were pulling hose lines. We had smoke machines pumping. We were pulling mannequins out live as fire victims. And we really have a great time doing that workshop. We've been doing it all over the country. And if you're interested in that training, please reach out to me at info@trainfirefighters.com. Now, what often happens in the wake of these classes is I tell the fire department who's hosting the class, hey, you're liable to have a fire in the next week or month or so. And without hesitation, Columbus Fire Department had a fire, and it was, I think it was the Thursday, if I'm right, after we were in town. So less than a week from our departure, they indeed had a working structure fire with a female trap. And they made a successful rescue, and she's going to make a full recovery. And we could not be more proud of Chief Andy Lay and the Columbus Fire Department. And so I've asked them to join us tonight, along with our other instructors and Chief Brian Brush from the Oklahoma, who is part of the Firefighter Rescue Survey enterprise that we've been talking about. He's been a guest on the show previously, and he has joined us tonight. He was in the class for the full 5 days with Columbus, and we have spent the past week celebrating this amazing rescue that they pulled off. And it just goes to show that you never know when the opportunities are going to come up, and you need to be ready. Our command workshop emphasizes not only the NIOSH 5, but the risk that is posed to the civilian victims out there. And we need to refocus our efforts on civilian rescue. And that's what we emphasize in Columbus, and it paid off less than a week later. So with that, I want to introduce our folks who are joining us tonight. It's an honor to have you all. They're going to share not only what they learned in the training, but they're going to share their fire that they had. And we're going to learn a lot from them tonight. So with that, I'd like to first start off by welcoming and introducing Chief Andy Lay from Columbus Fire. Chief, are you still with us?
I'm here. How's everybody doing?
It's great to have you here, Chief.
Great.
Thank you for joining us. Berge, you with us?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's Chief Robbie Bergerson from Waco, Texas Fire Department. And who else do we have from Columbus? I know we've got Mike Wilson. Are you with us?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chief.
All right. And Mike was in the class. And who else do we have from Columbus that's in that room full of folks? I know there's like about 60 in the room. So, Chief, who else is in the room with you?
We'll go around the horn here. We'll start with Lieutenant Sean McNeely. He was in the class.
Firefighter Cody Herkin.
Welcome, Sean.
Hey, thank you.
Firefighter Corey Hampton.
Firefighter Corey. Dan Smith.
Dan, what's your last name?
Smith.
Yeah, who else do we have?
Ben Spencer, Training Officer, Columbus Fire Department.
What's up, Red Brother?
How are you, Chief?
I'm doing great, brother. It's just such a joy to talk to you all. So we thought we were going to wait till FPIC to see each other, but here we are talking to each other already. And I want to – my hat's off to you, Ben. I know the Chief's proud of you. We're all proud of you. You made a Herculean effort to get that class done, and you worked on that AFG grant to get it paid for, and I think you did a fantastic job. Who else is in the room with you all?
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay, so we got four from Columbus, and we also have Mike Wilson from Columbus, and I think our other instructor, Dan Cottrell. Dan, are you with us, brother?
Yeah, can
Dan?
You hear me?
Can you hear me? I got you.
Can you hear
Dan Bales from Billings, Montana Fire Department, and he was at the class as well as Berge. And finally, we also have from Oklahoma, none other than Brian Brush. Can you still hear us, brother?
Yes, sir. Congratulations, Columbus, on all that training and preparation paying off big time. I appreciate it.
Awesome. So let's start with the fire. Let's talk about what happened. Tell us everything there is to know. I know a couple of you there were the firefighters that affected the rescue, so congratulations. It's a huge, huge accomplishment. So, Chief, tell us kind of what happened, what the layout was, what time of day, the building, just everything you want to tell us. Just feel free to give us as much detail as you want about this fire.
So it was late in the afternoon, pretty hot that day here in Indiana, and the call came in as a mattress on fire. I was actually in the office and started just to kind of drive down that way, and it was a single-story family residence. The call was there was heavy fire on the alpha side coming out. What was interesting was our battalion chief, who was not – our battalion chief who was in the class happened to be at fire station number 3 talking to our lieutenant, who was not in the class, about what we learned and how it was going to possibly fit into our system. And little bits and pieces of that stuck with him right out of the gate. As we listened to the arrival report, it was just spot on. He did a tremendous job with a awesome arrival report of what the conditions were, which was heavy fire and smoke coming out the A side. He went to do his 360, again doing his risk assessment. And as he walked around, they also were familiar with this resident as well as having a disabled person that lived there. So as they went around to the Charlie side, they were met with two other people in the house who were on their way out but could not get her out, and advised that there was somebody in there. And upon that information, they enacted the go for the rescue. And then that's when it all started. But the risk assessment was incredible. I think, you know, the communications were face-to-face. We've not implemented this yet, but a large portion of the people there were in the class and some were not. But we were actually doing it without even practicing this with our cruiser during any implementation whatsoever. So, and we had extra resources was another thing that really paid off for us. So right out of the gate, the battalion chief was calling for additional engines, which is something we haven't done in the past, additional medic crews. We had the EMS unit ready at the back porch that was ready to take the victim, get them out of there quickly, get them to Lifeline, to a Trauma One Center. So all that was something that I think your training prepared us for. So that's just kind of a little bit of highlights what I witnessed from my perspective. They just did an outstanding job. I'm so proud of them. Another thing we want to do is recognize them and get some medals of valor and medals of courage. We're going to be working on that here at our next Board of Works meeting on the 29th to showcase them in front of the Board of Works and the mayor and get a press release out and a photo op. So we're extremely proud of them. I couldn't be more proud. I'm also thankful and grateful for the training you provide. As I said, I followed you for quite some time back with the DVD series at FDIC and knew that that NIOSH 5 was something that could possibly impact us someday, because I knew there was room for improvement. And with all the hard work that Ben put in getting this grant and acquiring this has been a goal of mine. Once we got the training, it was just totally incredible the professionalism and talent that you all provided, and just felt like family right from the first day. So we couldn't be more proud of the training we received. We are committed to this 100%. We took some advice from Chief Castro's to get a strategic plan. We also took some advice to get a tactical plan and a task plan, and we implemented that with time dates and SMART goals, and we go live on our implementation on the 28th. So I want to thank you. I want to thank everybody that participated on that fire scene. It was incredible. I'm going to let the First Do Engine Company that was there give you a little more details, because they have a little more information than I do. But just very proud of them and proud of you. And now I'll turn it over to the First Do Company that arrived.
Hi, Chief. Cody Herkamp. I was on Engine 3. when we turned the corner going up the street that the fire was on, my lieutenant was giving orders of where the hydrant was for our engineer and telling me what he wanted me to do, which was to pull that first line off. On our arrival, we had heavy fire out of the AB corner window and visible fire on the A side window. As soon as I got off the line off, Lieutenant Maley went around for his 360, met with those two people that had come out, said we had a confirmed victim trapped. So I proceeded back to the Charlie side. That time Engine 1 arrived with Firefighter Corey Hampton, Firefighter Dan Smith. Me and Corey made entry. Extremely low visibility. The room was directly where she was at. It was directly to our right. The back door actually blocked access to that room. And the victim was trapped in a Hoyer lift, which is a medical lift device. So that complicated the rescue effort even further, trying to get her out of that. So
Let
Firefighter Hampton take over from there, because he's the one that...
So just to echo what Firefighter Herkamp said, I was on tail board of the second new engine. I got off. Met Lieutenant Bailey face-to-face. He told me to get with Firefighter Herkamp, that there was a confirmed entrapment. Met up with him, gave him pat on the back, said, let's go. We went in, advanced the hose line, about 5 feet and began a right-hand search. Initially, the way the house was set up, the door, back door being open blocked the room that she was in. It was not until I started to go backwards and I felt behind the door that I realized that there was a doorway there. And then I reached around, and that's when I actually felt her. And I let Firefighter Hurricane know that I had made contact with her, and then we pulled her down out of the smoke and began to pull her and the Hoyer lift into the area that we were in. And at that time, Lieutenant McNeely and Firefighter Dan Smith entered the structure with us and began to help us assist to remove her from the structure.
Outstanding. So at this time, you had pretty heavy black smoke and pretty minimal visibility and until you found her, right? Then you had to get low and you could bring her down and out?
We were met with heavy black smoke as soon as we entered the structure, about knee high. We went in crawling.
Right.
And she
went. Right.
So it was a hot, dark situation.
And so she was in the lift, which was above the smoke level, kind of trapped above the smoke level in the lift.
Yeah, she was in the smoke screaming for help. Said firefighter Panton and myself pulled her down with the lift, and then Lieutenant McNeil, Firefighter Smith came in, and to get her out of that room, we basically had to shut our egress door to get out to get her out. And at that time, it became zero visibility, extreme high heat, and she was entangled up in the Hoyer lift itself and the lifting mechanism. And trying to disentangle and cut her out was a little bit difficult.
Wow. So you had heavy heat, black smoke, a lot of fire. She's screaming. You had to go in, close the door to get to her, and then she's entangled in a Hoyer lift, and you're doing all this in zero visibility. Phenomenal job, you guys. Unbelievable. And so did she continue to talk, or did she lose consciousness in the process?
She continued to talk to some extent throughout the rescue. She never lost consciousness.
And my understanding, I looked at Facebook today, and I saw a Facebook post from her husband thanking you all for saving his wife of 53 years, and that she's going to make a full recovery, and she's doing well. So amazing, amazing, phenomenal.
This Lieutenant McNeely, at one point when the smoke and was banked to the floor, we were trying to get her out of that lift. I bent over and asked her. We were having trouble just making out what was what on the lift, the straps, the lift itself. We didn't realize the lift itself was caught behind her bedroom door, and we were trying to, thinking we were going to pull it. We weren't getting anywhere because the legs of that lift were actually in her room against the wall, so we couldn't advance that any further into the kitchen area. At one point, I leaned over to her, kind of found her head, leaned over and asked her if she was okay, which now thinking about it, having that question in those kind of conditions is kind of funny. Like, are you okay? I'm sorry you're breathing this smoke. And she actually told me, she said, I think I'm okay. And I said, we are trying to get you out here. We're trying to release you from this lift. And she said, okay. And then she started coughing. And not shortly after that is when she was released. Some straps were cut across that were holding her into the lift, like a nylon, two nylon straps. They were cut. She was released enough that she was able to come out.
Unbelievable. And meanwhile, what engine? Was it engine one that was attacking the fire?
Well, we took a line in with us, and in the process of trying to get her out of that lift, the lift moved a little bit and came right back in, and then she actually fell on top of the line, so we didn't have access to the line for a couple minutes. And then by the time we have access to it, myself and Lieutenant McLee were actually fighting over the line, trying to figure out who had it, to get water above our heads and start trying to get that heat knocked down.
Was that the only hose line in the house at the time?
Yes. There was one on the AB corner that they were trying to keep the fire knocked down and off of us. It was working a little bit, but it was starting to come towards us quickly.
Yeah, you can't. So were they doing like a transitional attack on from the outside, or were they, did they go in the front door? So while they were doing a transitional, you guys were in the rear with the hose line, and then the hose line became basically non-serviceable while you started to affect the rescue, and your heat was increasing and smoke was banking down more.
Yes.
Wow, awesome job, everybody. Hey, I've let's take a second here. I'm gonna ask Chief Rush to kind of chime in on this a little bit. And for those of you who are listening who don't know, Brian Brush is a battalion chief and training officer with Midwest City, Oklahoma, and he's really the driving force behind FirefighterRescueSurvey.com, and he's gave me the honor of coming along and following on his coattails to really get the word out about civilian rescue. This is something I've been emphasizing for the better part of 10 years, and now, thanks to the work of he and his colleagues at FirefighterRescueSurvey.com, we actually have some data to look at, not only quantitative but qualitative data to study and focus upon to help us be better at this job, which is driving our curriculum and tactics. So, Brian, as you hear this story unfold, why don't you just kind of share your thoughts? While you do, I'm going to bring in a couple more callers who I think are also from Columbus.
Yeah, I mean, I want to, once again, hats off to you guys. Just an amazing. Oops, did you guys get me now?
There you are.
Okay. Yeah, you know, hats off to Columbus Fire Department and the complexity of this incident. Really kind of highlights a lot of things. The full commitment of a company to the rescue is what really stands out. You guys recognized you had confirmed, and I heard that term specifically come out of several of you guys, so great work on that to relay that it is a confirmed rescue, you know the victim location, relaying that type of information. And then that initial resource goes all in on that effort. So that does take up time. Now, you guys had the confirmed rescue from the start, but when those victims are discovered in houses, it still takes up a full company. So great work to recognize you needed those additional resources, got them started so they could kind of backfill that rescue effort. What I want to kind of highlight that Chief talks about is we've done a great job with RIT and Mayday and kind of firefighter-centric efforts. And a lot of that was driven by the fire service because we got good information on firefighter rescues and firefighter RIT activations and information from NIOSH reports as well. But with that all being focused on firefighters, we tend to miss the exact parallels to civilian rescue. So almost all of us can absolutely repeat that it takes, you know, from the Phoenix study, I believe it was 15 firefighters to rescue one. Well, when we think about that, it should not surprise us one bit that it takes 3 to 4 firefighters to rescue one civilian when you consider that, you know, all the other complexities of rescuing a firefighter. So here we are, full complement. But also, when we think about RIT, we assign a RIT crew on a fire. We go through RIT training, all these types of things. RIT is just another rescue. So what I think is so interesting about this event, and I'd love to, you know, pry the firefighters a little bit more, but you encountered a civilian, but you encountered an entangled civilian in the sense they were in there in that, and I heard them talk about cutting straps, and I think that's really something we can do better in the fire service is communicate that rescues are rescues, whether they're in bunker gear or not, and all our preparation goes into rescue, and maybe just establishing such things as rescue groups and making rescue important, and not having it maybe handcuffed to a firefighter or to a civilian can just help us be that much more dynamic. I'm sure your efforts here with this civilian, maybe some of that training in the back of your mind of getting straps off of firefighters or getting straps connected to firefighters might have helped you managing getting her out of that lift. I almost wonder, due to the delay of trying to get her out of that lift, had a supplemental air supply been made available? So I think that there's a lot of tools, as Chief Castros and I have been talking, there's a lot of tools out there in the fire service that can help aid us in civilian rescue that we've really been just committing to firefighter rescue. And it's not that that's a bad thing. It's just an awareness thing.
You know, I'd like to dovetail off of Brian. I think that's spot on. You know, obviously you all had a complicated rescue, and the straps, you know, having the tools, having the extra air. I've been involved in rescues that took a lot longer than you would think. It's not quick like a mannequin. Sometimes it's once you get to them, the hard part starts just getting them out. And so those are some great thoughts. What I do want to confirm, though, or clarify is when I'm from a command standpoint, what we're teaching is if you have a group set up for rescue, like a rescue group with a group supervisor, because you have known victims, they're specifically looking for civilians. If you have a RIC group supervisor with companies, that's for firefighters. Because what can happen is you might have both at the same time, heaven forbid. And so it's always important that we separate RIC and the RIC function from the rescue function of civilians. So when we hear the term rescue, it's civilians. When we hear the term RIC, it's firefighters, because you just never know when it's going to be both. And the other benefit, like we talked about, and we actually did this in the workshop with the hands-on training, is sometimes you have to share resources, whether it's Division Alpha and RIC or Rescue Group and RIC. There's going to be sharing of resources, and that helps everybody understand that, okay, I've got this many companies going for the firefighters. I have this many companies still doing a search or attacking the fire, what have you under Alpha, for example. So really important that we separate the terminology. But to Brian's point, understanding the fact that cutting straps, supplemental air, all these other entanglement issues could still happen to a civilian as well, I think is a brilliant point. So let's continue on. Who else have we not heard from that was at the fire?
So Chief Castros, this has been, I want to bring in firefighter Dan Smith, talking about that supplemental air. You know, because he was talking earlier, we got together about a half hour before the conversation tonight, the podcast, and he actually brought that conversation up.
Yeah, in consideration of the hurdles that we were running into, there were several things mentioned that the removing the door was mentioned, using a saw or something to remove the door because the victim was laying just inside the door, and it became an issue. Because of the Hoyer lift, we could not drag her beyond the door so that the door could be reopened. So removing the door was considered. Air was considered. And I think one of the reasons that some of those things were considered and then not a significant amount of effort put into it is because she was right inside the threshold. And it's like in our minds, it's she's right there. We have to move her 2 feet, and she's out in clear air.
Right.
The time that we spend trying, and I understand hindsight's always 20/20, but it felt like she's right there. We can move her 2 feet and alleviate all of these issues, and it's hard to back up. I think when you're focused on what you're doing. It's hard to back up and think about, is there something, if this goes on for a minute or two, is there something else we ought to be doing?
From our training, I think it sounds like it's something maybe either a rescue group supervisor or a division supervisor could help you with. You know, say, hey, in other words, thinking in the next, like we did in the class, in the training, you know, because you all were focused in the now, right? You're totally focused right in front of you with this lady. The last thing you're thinking about is the next. And that's where your supervisor can help you, whether it's door removal or, you know, getting the gurney close by or getting supplemental air or whatever. That's what the benefit of that supervisor is for you. So great point.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So is the IC on the phone with us, the incident commander of this fire?
He is not.
So what was the layout or the organizational chart? How did he set up his incident command system? What divisions and groups did he have?
I'm not sure exactly how he started out. I think he did. He start out with the Alpha. When he first got there, like I said, he was getting the size up, doing the 360. I think he initially went Alpha and then set the crew to the back, to the Charlie side, for the rescue. So I think throughout the incident, again, we haven't implemented this, but it pretty much stayed with Alpha. And then the battalion chief arrived, who was in the class. Initially, he was outside of the vehicle, walking around getting eyes, and I think just due to the emotional issues that he was presented with, he's still in that mindset of not staying in the vehicle, but he still did a great job. He took the command role and kept Alpha with Lieutenant Maley, and then we had crews in the back. Deputy Chief Ziegler actually arrived as well, made a pretty quick response time and was packed up and geared, actually was right at the back door also working as a somewhat of a Charlie supervisor. And so he was very instrumental in that as well. And he was basically, it wasn't set up that he was assigned Charlie Division, but he took over and was Charlie Division, and Lieutenant Maley was Alpha, and the battalion chief was in command. And then I showed up, and I took over the rest of the city for the battalion chief and then worked with the EMS crew.
Great. Perfect. You know, considering the fact that this fire happened less than a week after the class, and you know, we had a pretty robust showing from the department, but the fact that it has not been implemented, not everybody's been through the training yet, which is why we do the train the trainer, so you can get everybody through it internally. It's amazing what a phenomenal job was done by everybody. I just love it. I just love hearing about it. Love it. What other things? Go ahead, Chief.
This is Lieutenant McNeely. I was just going to say, while we were talking, I was thinking about something you said in the class, and when we're going in for rescue, you need to have that line there placed between the fire and the rescue, the task level guys in there performing the rescue. That was the hardest thing. When I went in, I was third in the door behind the first two initial guys. I arrived on the truck with my truck crew. One other guy with my truck crew came up and also entered the building. He's not here tonight, Firefighter Chris Baker. And Firefighter Jeff Brown, they were both on the five or six of us that were there pulling the lady out. But taking that line when she's screaming in that room and the guys are trying to get her out of that Hoyer lift, taking that line and walking past her and putting yourself between the fire and the victim was very difficult. The line was in there, but I got task saturated with her screaming and those guys saying they needed help. At that point, the line went to the floor. I was helping drag her. So for a while, we didn't have that line placed between us and the fire and the victim.
Right.
Now, thinking back about that, I should have just carried on in that line and sit on the kitchen floor between them and the fire. So that's some of the stuff I was thinking about from the class maybe could have gave a can report in there as I was doing that for the guys behind me, letting everybody know what we were doing because, like Chief Lay said, we had far less radio traffic on this incident than we would have had beforehand because a lot of the players in this fire were actually in your training. So we had a lot of face-to-face. I know when I came out, my alarm bell was going off on my pack. I stepped out, and somebody took a picture, and Chief Ziegler passed it on to me. I've got a hold of his pack strap doing a face-to-face with him at the back door. Reminds me of the stuff that you were talking about. So that we're really doing, like Chief Lay said, we're implementing those things without even having this training yet. We're going ahead, and things are coming on board.
I love it, brother. Hey, and again, before I forget, thanks for the ride on that Stutz, brother.
Hey, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Here's a little shout out to. Go ahead.
Hey, Chief, this is Ben. Hey, sorry to cut you off. One of the things for me from the class, as I was driving in, I was delayed due to travel distance. I got to echo what the LT just said. There was some radio traffic there at the beginning, and I kept thinking to myself in the class, get in alignment. And I could tell almost immediately as soon as everything came into alignment because the radio traffic ceased. And then the next thing I heard was the victim's out. So, you know, that was one that I took away was as soon as they get into alignment, and it did, it took just a little bit, but once that alignment came into play, the radio traffic ceased, and it was kind of a back before the class when there's no radio traffic, you're thinking, what are they doing? Well, now, there's no radio traffic. You're like, they know that they're doing it, and as soon as the radio traffic next transmission was the victim's out. So that was something I took too.
That's a great observation, Ben, and that's true. This is where the trust and the training, like we said, time plus training equals trust. And I just can't wait to see where you're going to be. Chief, when did you say official implementation is going to happen? Is it going to be, what, later this month, in about a week?
We're going on the 28th Monday, day one, with our start time. We've got two SMART goals. The first SMART goal is to get the orientation of why we're doing this. And then SMART goal number two is to begin to start going through the PowerPoint presentation, and then we will move on to a couple more SMART goals. But we're hoping that we can get this implemented fairly soon. And I think one thing I've noticed about this is everybody that was in the class is so positive, and then you piggyback with the rescue that just took it over to the next level. The naysayers are going to jump on board really quick. I think it's improved morale. I think it's got us focused back to our roots of why we want to be firefighters and that we love this job. And I think the passion and enthusiasm is there. And this all stems, like we talked about in class, from the training and getting back to our roots and doing that victim profile, and why we're really here is for the community to save lives. And this just highlights it. So I really don't think this is going to take long to get implemented. I was a little nervous at first, thinking I would get pushback, and that's why we brought you in and your group of instructors to show that you know what you're talking about, and we want to take this training and implement it into our fire department so that we can be the best we can be.
Well, Chief, you've done that and then some, and I know it was a team effort. It was started with your vision and your leadership. I know that your ops chief was 100% on board, Chief Ziegler. You had all your battalion chiefs were on board. Obviously, training officer Spencer, Ben did a phenomenal job of task level work, and it was just a joy to see everybody come together. And I can't think of a better organization more deserving of this amazing event. And you earned it. It's not like it was a gift. You earned it. You worked your butts off. You put yourselves at risk. You put yourselves out there. And you applied what you learned immediately, and there will be others. And this is what gives me and our team of instructors such joy in why we do what we do. When I heard from you all, which I can't thank you enough, whether it was Mike Wilson or the fire chief or Ben, and then I actually heard from it first from Chief Rush from Oklahoma, because he's tenacious about getting these grabs. But then to read the husband's, his post on Facebook, thank you for saving my wife, and just wow. So I want to bounce back to the training a little bit and give my instructors an opportunity to talk about what we do and why we do it. And having heard, the firsthand account of what happened, maybe kind of circle back on this and some of your thoughts. So I'm going to start with Dan, who's our tactical supervisor, and Bergie, because they really are the ones that make this happen. Bergie, Chief Bergerson from Waco, took time away from his family, away from work, to be there, come from Texas to Columbus, Indiana, was in the command post for 2 days of countless scenarios. And then Dan Cottrell came from, same thing, away from family, taking time off, came all the way from Billings, Montana. So here you truly have firefighters from all over the country helping each other. We had brothers from and sisters from all over the country, multiple states. So, Bergie, why don't you kick us off kind of from the command post standpoint. Tell us what your observations were throughout the 2 days and what we do, why we do, and how you can connect what they just told you about their fire.
Well, first off, you know, Columbus, congratulations. It's an amazing grab. Chief Lay, just awesome. I went back as soon as Brian Brush actually texted me about the fire, like Chief Castro said, and I went on Broadcastify and listened to the audio of your fire like about an hour, maybe 2 hours after it happened, and I could tell that things were going well. The radio traffic was very tamped down, like everyone said. But, yeah, from the command post, just over the last or the 2 days of the training, you know, we saw the incident commanders get things into alignment, and somebody said it. Ben, you said that once you knew everything was in alignment, the radio traffic almost stopped, and that's right. And I think all of the chiefs and acting chiefs that were in the command post, you know, they saw it. The first day, obviously nervous, and it's really started to come together toward the end. One of the things I'd like to speak about, too, just from listening to this, it's something I mentioned in class, and I've seen it in my own city, is don't fall for the trap of survivability profile. Because I saw the pictures of the fires you guys encountered, and you can easily look at that, and a lot of departments would across the country and think that somebody wouldn't be alive in there, and you didn't give up, and you gave that woman a chance, and you saved her life, so that's amazing. And another thing I wanted to ask a question of some of the first companies was we talked about in the class getting the signal when we have a confirmed rescue. Was there any discussion of that? Did that help if you knew that she was entangled before you went in?
We really – the only thing that they told us was she was in the bedroom, and I run on her – been on her 4 or 5 times. We know she has the Hoyer lift. My initial thought was she was in the bed. Then whenever me and Firefighter Hampton went in and he felt around that door and felt her up high and not down low, we knew at that point she was in that lift. And that kind of changed a little bit how we were going, you know, wasn't just to go in, drag her out and out the door. It was changing how we had to affect that rescue. We knew we needed a few more people, which they were right behind us coming in. And I think total was counted between the firefighters and EMS and a couple of police officers at the back door. There was 11 of us in that general 10-foot area of assisting in getting her out of there.
Wow. And, you know, you just said it just then. You've been on her multiple times. You knew the layout of the house. You knew her. You knew the Hoyer lift. You know, I'm confident then that, you know, in the next 6 months, a victim profile is going to be announced by Columbus Fire on every fire, and that a signal will be given when necessary. It sounds like this signal was we have a elderly female in the back who's in a Hoyer lift you know, alone, whatever. Maybe is she non-ambulatory, like completely non-ambulatory, or can she walk a little, or how what's her status? Does she help at all, or just dead weight?
I believe she's non-ambulatory. There, I believe the two other guys that were in the house with her were getting her in the Hoyer lift to put her on a mechanical wheelchair to get her out, and they got ran out by the high heat and smoke. So every time that we've actually been on her, she has not walked herself anywhere. Able to ambulate.
Well, you know, Chief Ferguson brought up a good point about the victim profile versus survivability profile. Chief Ferguson, for our listeners out there, can you elaborate a little bit on that for those who may not have heard that term?
Sure. When we're talking about survivability profile, there's been a lot of teachings over the last several years in the fire service of looking at the building and deciding whether or not someone could live or die in that environment. But there's also a lot of discussion about survivable space in buildings. And I know I've seen it in my own city where you would never believe that someone would be alive inside the building, and we've removed them and you know, they've been back to normal within a week. So I don't subscribe to that at all. There's always survivable space. And one of the things we teach in the class is doing victim profiling instead of survivability profiling, because it's all about the person we're trying to rescue. So we go with a low or moderate victim profile if we don't know the circumstances. And then high victim profile is like a fire at night. Maybe in the day, at night when cars are in the driveway, we don't see anybody outside, but, or an apartment building, that may be a high victim profile, where more of the focus may be on search and rescue rather than fire attack. And then confirmed rescue is this situation, which is a confirmed victim profile. We knew, or you guys knew that someone was in the building, and you made the rescue attempt. So,
isn't it amazing when you train? And there's always we've all been firefighters a long time. We all go to drills and trainings, and there's always a piece of you in the back of your mind. You're thinking, okay, am I really going to use this? Does this really work? And I know I've been a firefighter, and when I was a young firefighter, I remember sometimes I'd be in a situation and my adrenaline overrode my training. You know, I tried to muscle through something, or it's like I was never even trained. I tried to, you know, take a door with my shoulder or something stupid instead of doing what I was trained to do. And I'm just proud of everybody for sticking to the training. And these are perishable skills. And the fact that you already have a plan, like the chief mentioned, a SMART goal, set of SMART goals, right? Specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. And those goals are going to serve you well. And the fact that you're breaking them down to strategic, tactical, and task level goals are critical. So just can't say enough. So Dan, if you're still with us, you know, you're kind of the workhorse of the three of us when we go doing these classes around the country. The instructors who fill, in this case, Dan's role in the course, spend 2 days really hammering the tactical supervisor position, either a division supervisor or a group supervisor. And we talk about being highly hostile, agile, and mobile. And so Dan is really great at that. It's a natural fit for him to teach it. Dan, could you kind of share what you saw in the 2 days at Columbus and how you heard it manifest itself in this fire?
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, great job, guys. Great job, and thanks for having me on your call. And Andoni, what I love about you is you put us on the spot. You know, you called me this morning and said, "Hey, do you want to listen in on the call?" And here we are, me and Bergie on the spot giving a talk. So I love you for that, brother. So I do this program for a couple of reasons, and every time I do it, I kind of reevaluate my goals and am I getting out of it what I want to get out of it. And what I want to get out of it, one of the great things that I want to get out of it that I have seen in every class that I've helped out with, and we've talked about this, Andoni, you and I and Bergie just talked about this a few weeks ago in Columbus, is refueling those incumbent firefighters, the company officers, captains, battalion chiefs, and so forth, that are, you know, we're old salts. We've been at this a long time. We've seen a lot of Kool-Aid in our careers, and a lot of us have called it out as that. And I did that when this program came to my agency, and I saw the value of it once I got hands-on. And I loved watching the transformation of the men and women at Columbus do the same thing. I watched them on the first day have skepticism and question things. And as we started putting boots to the ground and we started seeing how this program works and how it can be beneficial in filling what we call the tactical gap, right? We call them the chaos at the scene by filling that gap between the task level crews that are doing the hands-on work and the supervisors in the buggies. And we fill that gap and we make sure things aren't getting lost in that transition. And to sit and watch these guys get refueled and reinvigorated is so gratifying to me. And the result of that is we've got incumbent firefighters that are going to work that are happy to be at work again, that are wanting to share things with the young guys and gals on the job to not only improve their skills, but improve the department, improve how we serve our communities. But in the end, the big difference that we make was shown on this call. There's a few reasons we do it, right? We do it because we want to get that grab. We want to help those people in that time of need. And the other reason we do this type of program is because when we're in need, you know, when we're in doing our job, and whether we've used the proper risk assessment or not, we put ourselves in a situation where we need to rely on each other. And this program allows us to do that in an efficient manner. And I just haven't seen anything else in, you know, 24 years as a career firefighter. I haven't seen anything that works better. It's all things that we already do. It's just putting them together in a chronological order. And I just love being involved with it. I loved watching the transition, and I've heard small pieces of this program put to work on this rescue 1 week after we were there, and pieces helped make a difference. The face-to-face communication, the tactical supervisors, when they were available. I understand that it takes some discipline to stay in that tactical role, and maybe that didn't happen, but we learned from that, and the next time that's going to be better. So it's just gratifying to me. It's just a wonderful thing, and I'm just proud to be a part of it.
Thank you, brother. Well, I've said it before. I've said it to the chief, to Chief Lay. I've said it to all of you on this call that I do believe that we're blessed to do this work. I think we're doing God's work. We're hopefully making a difference because, we've all been learning over the past 10 years that fires are growing faster and that the environment is more and more toxic and the margin for error is almost zero. It's nil. And the window of opportunity to make a save like you did here slams shut so fast, and you can't afford to have these NIOSH 5 issues. They might not result in the death of a firefighter, but they can result in the death of this lady if you weren't on top of those issues, which you were. So, again, to echo Dan's sentiment and Bergie, just so gratifying, and thank you for sharing the story with us. Is there any other? I want to make sure that we didn't leave anybody out. Mike Wilson, you've been patiently listening. From your perspective, I imagine you've been in touch with the family, maybe, or I know you're handling the PIO duty. From your perspective, how has this impacted the department and the community?
Well, we certainly did. We had a lot of social media response to this from the community. You know, they enjoy seeing their firefighters out in the community, and of course, with a successful rescue, got a lot of support from our community members. The family is doing very well. The mother it was an adult son, a husband and wife that lived in the home. The female, she did suffer a broken arm throughout the ordeal, and understandably had high carbon monoxide levels. But she's expected to make a full recovery, and the family's doing well. We are awaiting to hear back with them to help them with some temporary emergency shelter if they need that. But as you said and alluded to, Chief, the family is very thankful. From a public information officer perspective, these are the kind of stories that are wonderful to get out into the community to highlight our work as a public safety agency. Oftentimes we are kind of a necessary evil in terms of taxpayers' dollars, but these are the things that make all that training and the money that you put into equipment and training and it makes it all worthwhile when you have a rescue like this. So we've got wonderful support from our community. We've got excellent support from our city administration. Chief Lay and Captain Spencer, they reached out and said that this is a valuable training program that is really going to help our department move in a positive direction. We want to operate best practices in mind, and
I can just see from an organizational perspective, I think our whole department's excited right now, obviously about making a successful grab, but just in terms of our desire as a as an agency to get better at everything we do and serve our customers the best way we can. So it's been wonderful.
Well said, brother. You know, I hope there's a lot of fire chiefs listening or aspiring fire chiefs listening to this show because this all started because Chief Lay made it a priority. And, you know, he reached out to our team years ago, and we've been working on getting this done. And as I mentioned earlier, we've been blessed to teach this around the country a lot, but I have rarely seen the fire chief be there all 5 days, the hands-on portion, in turnouts, sweating, SCBA on his back, going into the smoke, you know, being both the incident commander, I think he was the first one to volunteer, and then being the tactical supervisor role. I mean, and this is Columbus, Indiana in the summertime, so it was hot and humid, and, you know, it was just gratifying to see, and all the battalion chiefs were all in, and everybody else, and of course, Captain Spencer and, you know, and Captain Wilson and everybody else, the ops chief was there just kicking butt, helping us out, supporting us. It was an all-in effort, as our friend would say, from Palo Alto. And I think that this is what's required to affect change, is you need to have it top-down. Everyone talks about bottom-up change, and I think bottom-up change is great. I've been part of it, but as we all know, gravity is in effect, and things naturally go from the top to the bottom. That's just the way water flows. That's the way gravity works. And when you're fighting against that current and trying to flow upstream, it can be really hard. In this case, that wasn't the issue. You had an all-in effort, an all-in attitude and all-out effort. And so hats off to everybody who was there. I can't thank our instructors, our team enough, to Robbie and Danny. And I just, you know, I know. Oh, he's so right. I always put you guys on the spot. I say I won't, but I do. I can't help myself. Chief Lay and the rest of the gang from Columbus, is there anything you want to add about, you know, lessons learned or anything you think would be of value to our listeners?
Chief, this is Ben Spencer. I think one of the main things that I took away from it, and Bergie hit on it, was the victim profiling. I think that I don't want to say complacency. I don't want to say laziness, but the number of structure fires seems to be trending down, and I think that we can accredit that to inspections, prevention, that sort of thing. The fires that we do have, most of the time it seems like everybody's out. Everybody's accounted for. We're still going to do a search. We're still going to do primary search. We're going to still do secondary search. But it just seems like, you know, 15, 20 house fires we go to, we kind of get in this subconscious thought that everybody is going to be out. You know, coming off the truck, combat ready, getting that victim profile is very, very vital right from where we go. And we talked in class about how the building is going to dictate what we do. The victim profiling is going to dictate what we do. Grab a hold of that early. Even if you have a confirmed everybody is out, we're still going to search. We're going to still do that sort of thing. One of the takeaways that I took was bread and butter is no longer a good statement to have. Oh, this is just a bread and butter house fire. This is a normal thing that we go on a lot because we have that IWI, that incident within an incident. It could be the fact that we have a major call, you know, the roof collapse, that sort of thing. Getting ahead of that power curve like you talked about in class, you know, because eventually your butter is going to fall off the bread at that point in time. And you definitely need to be ahead of that. So try your best not to become complacent. You know, always be taking classes, always be talking about how you could get better. I'm so proud of these guys. I've been calling them heroes all week. They're so sick of me calling them heroes, but I mean, truly, that's what they are. And you ask any of them, they're going to tell you that they just did their job. But you know what? To a mother and a wife and her family, you know, she's still on God's earth because of this crew, and they did just an outstanding job, and so they were ready, they were educated, they were ready to go to work, and they didn't let complacency stand in their way that day, and I know going forward they won't. But just have that victim profiling. Don't treat house fires like they're bread and butter. Always stay ahead of that curve. Always get your resources in line. Because like Lieutenant McNeely's favorite thing, you know, the scene is going to do something weird. Just when you think that the curve is going to go down, it's going to do something, and it's going to amp back up. So, you know, learn from that. Don't treat your house fires like bread and butter. Treat them as their own animal, because that's what they are.
Amen. Well said. Well
Chief
said.
Castro.
Anybody else from the room? Yes,
yeah,
sir.
Chief Castro. It's Andy Lay here. One of the big takeaways I had from this class, I was brought up under the system of everything goes to the incident commander. You have to get your orders and a lot of communications and no disobedient loyalty. You know, that was not allowed. You get your orders and you follow them and that's it. And one of the big takeaways I have about filling the tactical gap in those supervisors is going to be so instrumental in our growth, is because we're going to empower our officers to be officers. And that's just going to make our department so much better, because they're going to have the competence, the respect, they're going to have the experience that was never given to them before by being in that system,
right,
where everything goes through one incident commander. And that empowerment is not only going to be contagious on the fire ground, but we talked about this also within the firehouse with everything that we do.
Yep.
They're going to be looked up as what they truly are, as heroes, and respected that they have each other's backs and they know their job. They know how to do it. So big takeaway for me from my perspective is the empowerment.
Amen to that, Chief. And it comes from the top down. You know, you can't have empowerment unless the boss gives it to you. And you've done that. And you've proven that. You're a servant leader. And I see that throughout your organization. And so as we wrap up here, I want to just thank everybody, especially not only the Columbus Fire Department Chief Lay, but Brian Brush and Robbie Bergeson and Danny Cottrell for really – taking more time, not only being at the class, but following up, you know, Brian giving us the info initially because you're just on top of it, the incredible body work you're doing, Chief for your example, Bergie and Dan for your commitment, and just, again, hats off to everybody. For those of you listening, if you're interested in hosting this kind of training, it's phenomenal. It is. You can use an AFG grant to pay for it. Columbus, Indiana, had the full support of the city. The mayor was there the first day. The chief invited the mayor. He was there to kick it off, and he's all in. And the chief did the legwork to get the city behind it, to get the AFG grant done, and also to get the grant also covered overtime and backfill and everything. And the whole organization got involved. So if you're interested in this kind of training, reach out to us at info@trainfirefighters.com. That's all one word, info@trainfirefighters.com. We're doing it all over the country. We're booking 2022 right now and thinking about 23, so get a hold of us. God bless everybody on this call, and thank you, God, for this save. God bless everybody listening, and God bless the American Fire Service and those you serve and those you lead. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Check on a 6 9 7, show your responding on the